Over the last few weeks, the eyes of the world have been fixed on Armenia. The small country in the southern Caucasus, with a population of approximately 3 million, has just witnessed one of the most highly anticipated elections in its recent history. On the 7th of June, the Civil Contract Party, led by Armenia's incumbent Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, won a resounding victory with nearly 50% of the vote. The outcome has strengthened the Prime Minister's call for closer ties with the European Union, while dealing a major blow to his pro-Russian rivals. Yet there was more to the contest than a straightforward clash between Russia and the West. The election will also affect other powers with a stake in the Southern Caucasus, including China, India, Turkey, and the Gulf states. Meanwhile, the vote has major implications for a potential peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Armenia's neighbour and adversary in recent conflicts. So what are the geopolitical consequences of the Armenian elections? Do they signal a decisive turn in the country's orientation towards the West? And what impact will they have in the Caucasus and beyond? This is Jack Dickens, literary editor at Engelsberg Ideas. To discuss the Armenian elections and their aftermath, I am delighted to be joined by Thomas Duval, senior fellow at Carnegie Europe. Tom is a former BBC journalist and an expert on Russia and the Caucasus. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Glad to be with you.
Tom, to start off with, can you give us a sense of the political landscape in Armenia at the moment, and what was at stake in these recent elections?
Well, as you've said, the political landscape is shaped around orientation towards Russia, and the ruling party, which wants to diversify Armenia's foreign policy. No one, I think, in Armenia wants to get rid of Russia altogether. Russia dominates the economy, has a military base there, provides Armenia with gas and so on. So even if you want to, and I think this ruling party does want to in the long term, get rid of the Russian influence, you have to balance it. So it was a contest between three basically outwardly pro-Russian parties, which will now form the opposition, or maybe two of them, we don't know yet, and the ruling party, which wants this more diversified position. But as you've already mentioned, the other big issue is a peace process with Azerbaijan and Turkey. The borders with those two countries, Armenia's two longest borders, have been closed for more than 30 years. Turkey, in solidarity with Azerbaijan, its Turkic neighbour and kin state. And this government, this prime minister, is set on, you know, normalising relations and continuing a peace process with them. The opposition doesn't want that. And many other factors in the background, including the Armenian diaspora, who's also opposed largely, or its political organizations opposed to this prime minister. So an awful lot of stake, domestic issues, Europe versus Russia, a peace process. It's certainly a very consequential election.
You talk about diversification and balancing. Do you think that there's a danger that in European capitals, the media and also policymakers might interpret this as a straightforward pivot towards the West, and they might miss some of the complexity of what's going on in Armenia at the moment?
Absolutely right. And some of the commentary you saw after the election was another blow to Russia, Europe wins, as though this is a kind of chess game with two players in the South Caucasus. I don't think that's true. I think there are many other actors there in the South Caucasus, as you've alluded to, from, you know, China, Turkey, Iran, India, the Gulf states. And I also don't think it's helpful in the sense that, in Russia, they've also been portraying this in a binary fashion. President Putin, just before the election, said that Armenia needs to choose, needs to hold a referendum. Does it want to remain a part of the Eurasian Economic Union with us, or does it want to join the EU? That's a false choice. Armenia will stay part of the Eurasian Economic Union for the foreseeable future, simply the way the economy is structured, and no one is really seriously talking about EU membership. But when you get a lot of these European commentaries, it does look a bit like wishful thinking. You don't really want a straight fight with Russia in a country like Armenia, which Russia has dominated for 30 more and more years.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the man who seems to be at the centre of all this, Nikol Pashinyan, the Armenian Prime Minister? What is his personal story? What was his path to power?
Yeah, a very interesting, charismatic, and I would say rather erratic figure. He went to jail in Armenia in 2008 for his opposition politics, and then was released, and, you know, seemed to be a rather marginal opposition figure. But he's got an extraordinary knack of populist politics for communicating with the crowd. In 2018, Armenia had 20 years of two very close comrades in power, one after the other, Presidents Kocharyan and Sarkisyan, both from Nagorno-Karabakh, from outside Armenia, both quite close to Russia. And there was a indication that they wanted to change the constitution so that President Sarkisyan could become prime minister, stay in power. So there was an assumption, a supposition that this regime would try and continue after two decades. Everyone believed that would happen. Nikol Pashinyan led this popular revolt going from village to village, town to town across Armenia, which suddenly gathered enormous steam. And then we saw this, what people called the Velvet Revolution, this peaceful revolution where basically they brought Armenia to a halt. Sarkisyan thought the game was up, resigned, and suddenly he was catapulted into power from opposition, marginal oppositional politics only a few months earlier, to becoming prime minister. He's, as I said, a very, very good communicator, but also, you know, like many people across the world, a better of that nature, more of a populist revolutionary than a leader, very little institutionalization, very personalized rule. And that has led him into major disasters, two military defeats against Azerbaijan in the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh, and led him also to this rather courageous position of trying to tear up Armenia's previous foreign policy. So a man of many contradictions who is now set to be in power for another 4 or 5 years in Armenia.
And how is he viewed within the country itself?
He was a messiah, basically, in 2018. He was, you know, Jesus Christ. Everyone, you know, young people in particular, loved him. That's all completely faded. His support is now outside the capital. It's with villagers, people who want stability, people who want no regime change. So the complete opposite. The capital has really very much turned against him. And voted against him in this election, but he benefits from the fact that he's not the most popular exactly, but the least unpopular politician in Armenia. The opposition candidates were really not credible at all.
And there is a cautionary tale in the Caucasus, and that is Georgia. And you've warned that there might be some unfortunate parallels between a desire for European statesmen to over-invest and over-pin all of their wishes upon Prime Minister Pashinyan, and the experience of what happened in Georgia in the 2000s, where the United States and the European Union, again, over-invested in a particular individual who they thought would bring the country towards the West, would prize open this window towards the European Union. Can you explain what you see as the dangers moving forwards?
Yeah, well, the person we're talking about here as a bad president is Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia, who came to power also on a peaceful revolution, popular protest in Georgia in 2003. It was called the Rose Revolution. Also a very charismatic individual, also an egotist and with a very personalized style of government, enormous success in his first years, but all the love that was coming to him from the West, particularly from Washington, who wanted to kind of set him up as a kind of counterweight to Putin, his desire to join NATO very quickly, all of that, you know, led to trouble. It led to trouble with Russia, which, you know, had already had its conflicts with Georgia, but began to see Saakashvili as a particular threat. And it led to very personalized and non-institutionalized rule within the country, abuse of power a point Armenia has not got to yet, but there are a few warning signs of that. So all I think a cautionary tale about betting on one force in a polarized country, about openly provoking Russia or too openly, and betting on one individual. So I think some lessons to be learned there. To be fair, Mr. Pashinyan, you know, says he doesn't want to break with Russia. He continues to visit Russia. He continues to be part of Russian-led institutions. He's talking about a diversification rather than a divorce. But some of the comments coming from European commentators on this election have definitely not been helpful.
I would like to dwell on the Russian response now to Pashinyan's re-election. Where does this leave the geopolitical architecture, as it were, that Russia uses to project influence into the former Soviet space, or the post-Soviet space, as it's sometimes called, such as the Eurasian Economic Union and the Collective Security Treaty Organization, both of which, of course, Armenia is a member of? Where does it leave Russian influence in the near abroad?
Yeah, well, talking of the near abroad, I wrote a long publication a couple of years ago, which I entitled The End of the Near Abroad. And I think that's basically a process that's happening. It started in the 1990s, this idea that Russia could have a kind of sphere of influence, an economic zone of interest around it. You know, Russia has lost almost all its soft power in the region. People are not consuming Russian media. These countries have diversified their economies. Russia remains a strong economic partner for members of that Eurasian Economic Union, which is basically Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Central Asia, Belarus, and Armenia. So it's rather a disparate bunch. You know, Russia is no longer the hegemon as far as these countries are concerned. They have multiple partnerships. They're looking to, you know, whether it be China or Turkey or wherever. And so I think, you know, there are many explanations for why Russia invaded Ukraine, or Putin invaded Ukraine in the manner he did in 2022. But one of them, I would say, is the failure of those soft integration projects that he tried over the years. The Eurasian Economic Union wasn't working. The CSTO, as it's called, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the kind of attempt to mimic NATO, was also very problematic. Russia was basically not using it as it should, and the Armenians were complaining that they didn't feel protected by Russia when they were fighting Azerbaijan. So, you know, Russian media, Russian language, all in decline in this region. Doesn't mean that Russia isn't important, but it just lost that big hegemonic status. And we see that process, you know, unfolding in the South Caucasus. Russia has now lost the major lever it had over Armenia and Azerbaijan, which was the conflict between them, specifically the conflict over this territory, Nagorno-Karabakh, which Azerbaijan, you know, won by force in 2023. And Russia can no longer manipulate as it once did. And Russia is going to have to readjust to that new rule, that new role and rule, we might say. You know, and obviously the distraction and the enormous bleeding that Russia suffers in Ukraine is another factor. Simply to project power in other bits of the neighbourhood simply isn't possible anymore.
So what do you think the Russian response will be? Do you think there'll be a pragmatic response, or do you think that the Kremlin will be hell-bent on some kind of revenge? And does it have the capacity to avenge itself in that way?
Russia basically has one big instrument to use against a country like Armenia, and that's an economic instrument, but what it can do is inflict economic punishment, and it's actually done that already. Prior to the election, they suddenly decided that Armenian flowers, Armenian strawberries, were unsanitary, even including, as some Armenians joked, you know, some strawberries that had not yet been picked off the plant were deemed unsanitary, and. You know, the problem with that strategy, and we've seen this before in places like Georgia and Moldova, is that you inflict economic pain on the country, but you don't buy its loyalty by banning its imports. And then that they are forced to diversify their economy, so it doesn't really benefit Russia. The other thing they can do is raise the gas price, which is artificially low, and I think Armenia will have to brace itself for that. But again, that will just be an invitation for Armenia to, you know, to diversify its, you know, energy sector. You know, obviously some people think, would Russia use outright physical force to keep someone like Mr. Pashinyan, you know, to oust him from power? Again, I don't see how that could happen. Russia has no shared border with Armenia. There's one small Russian military base, but, you know, obviously Mr. Pashinyan has been in power for several years. He has his own security forces, you know, and he's taking measures against a scenario like that. I guess, you know, Armenia's weakness, you know, and it's very important to discuss this, is its closed borders with Turkey and Azerbaijan. So Russia's other big instrument is to try and slow down the peace process with Azerbaijan and keep those borders closed.
Thinking about geopolitical diversification, there is also a Trumpian element to this story as well, and the fact that Donald Trump has been quite active in trying to negotiate a peace between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and that will be sweetened by US investment and, of course, a kind of Trump route that binds the two countries together. Does this fact that the, you know, the US president is so interested at the moment in Armenia create a kind of unique set of geopolitical circumstances for the country?
It does, and that also applies to Azerbaijan. And there's a Russia factor here as well, in that after, you know, Azerbaijan's military victory, let's you know, be plain, that's what it was in 2023 over Armenia, and the conquest, the capture of Nagorno-Karabakh, you know, Russia continued to want to be the main broker between the two countries. And both countries no longer wanted that. They started to negotiate bilaterally on a peace and normalization agreement. But the Russian shadow was already there. And then there's this issue of that Azerbaijan is in two pieces. It has an exclave called Nakhchivan, which is its kind of Alaska in geographical terms, you know, to paint that analogy, which is separated from the rest of Azerbaijan by this strip of Armenian territory. And clearly, you know, the Azerbaijanis want to reconnect with that territory, restore the road and railway which was there in Soviet times. And the Armenians also need, you know, to de-isolate themselves. So, but a very tricky issue to negotiate between, on the one hand, access for Azerbaijan and sovereignty for Armenia. And the Russians had a definite interest in that bit of territory, and in an agreement signed in 2020, it was the Russian FSB, the border guards, who were supposed to take charge of that route. Last year, I think both countries realized this was not in their interest, and they were looking around for a way to get out of this. And Steve Witkoff appears. Steve Witkoff was flying to Moscow from the United States via Baku and stopping to talk to the Azerbaijanis en route. And he basically offered the US as a new broker, and which is why last August suddenly you had this meeting in the White House, this new Trump route for international peace and prosperity. A bit cringe-making, but it signified suddenly that the US was swinging in there with using its power and resources to finally settle this issue. Then, you know, the US and Armenia have now formed a joint company to manage this route. The modalities are being put in place so that Azerbaijan can have fairly free access across Armenian territory. So both sides being satisfied, plus some sweetener deals, bilateral economic deals for Armenia with microchips, NVIDIA microchips, a base being set up there, and Azerbaijan an energy deal. So suddenly this was a deal that was in the interests of Armenia and Azerbaijan, but also the US, because I think, you know, another factor here obviously is that Trump had said about a year ago that he'd solved 8 conflicts, but when he looked around at most of them, they were extremely problematic. This one, I think, is the most promising of the lot. I think it will happen. I think Iran is a complication. But, you know, I talked to the Americans who are doing this deal. They talked to Europeans and British counterparts. It's a bit more of old-fashioned US diplomacy in this deal than in some of the others.
In a way, an advertisement for some unorthodox approaches to old questions. Certainly the real estate mogul diplomacy has come up with an interesting approach here. You did mention Iran. I wonder whether you could tell us why that is potentially providing a problem at the moment. As I understand it, the proposed Trump route does go very close to Armenia's border with Iran. Is that just a logistical issue?
Well, it's one to be watched, because the route actually goes along a river, the River Arax, which comprises the Armenia-Iran border. So on the Armenian side of the border, there was a railway which will be rebuilt, and you can see Iran from that route. So I think there's a practical issue which the Americans were dealing with was, while the conflict was going on, you know, can we really deploy US personnel to do technical studies, feasibility studies, and get this going when Iran is just across the border? There's also obviously an economic angle. Are we going to attract investors to this project, which we also want to make a major kind of east-west transit route? So I think remains to be seen. I think Iran is a bit split on this. Some, the more pragmatic parts of the Iranian elite think we should just go along with this route. We can actually end up using it. And then there's the hardliners, probably Republican Guard types, who see anything with an American flag attached to it as a target. But certainly America, kind of gave with one hand last year by this route, and is sort of undermining its own policy with the other hand, but by its war in Iran.
And there are obstacles to securing this peace deal, both within Azerbaijan and in Armenia too, and particularly when you consider that both leaders of both countries need to consider how they will sell this to their populations and how they will try and make domestic changes in Armenia's case that will allow them to pursue the peace deal that is on offer. Could you take us through those obstacles?
Sure. To take us back, since 1991, Armenia and Azerbaijan became independent, but have not have had no diplomatic relations, have not recognized each other's territory. There was the Armenian exclave of Nagorno-Karabakh within Azerbaijan, populated heavily by Armenians, which was the cause of the conflict in the 90s, which then, was a terrible war. Mass displacement of Azerbaijanis in particular, but also Armenians, which resulted in Armenia, controlling that territory and much more besides. Azerbaijan reversed that in 2020 and then again in 2023, and has completely reversed that. So the conditions are now there, thanks to the rather tragic end of that conflict, for each side to recognize each other's territorial integrity, for them to open borders and move forward. But Azerbaijan, which is the victor, and therefore less in a hurry than the Armenian side, the Azerbaijani president, taking his time, has set one more condition, which is that Armenia needs to have a new constitution, because the old constitution has a reference to the Declaration of Independence, which refers to the union of Armenia and Karabakh. It's not something that anyone had particularly noticed, but once Azerbaijan raised this issue, they've become quite stubborn and say Armenia needs a new constitution, which is easier said than done, because in Armenia, to call a constitution, you need to call a constitutional referendum, you need a two-thirds majority in parliament. Now, Mr. Pashinyan's party has just fallen short of that by a few seats, and the opposition will be sure to block it if they take their seats in parliament. So suddenly we've got a lot of internal wrangling in Armenia. Does Pashinyan try and get this two-thirds majority, push through a new constitution? Even if he gets that vote, the impression that Azerbaijan, our enemy, is imposing on this us on this may, you know, cause a lot of voters simply to vote no. We all know we're British. What can go wrong in a referendum 10 years ago this month in the UK? So it's looking problematic, I think, for Armenia to be able to change its constitution for a number of reasons. And so we're in this funny situation now that the conflict seems to be over between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They have a peace agreement, they've initialed it, but they haven't signed it. So the conflict is I think definitely over, but peace has not happened, and it needs some sort of some good diplomacy to get this right now.
I mean, we spoke earlier about creative, unorthodox diplomatic solutions. Are there any proposals so far about what might be done to get around this constitutional issue?
I think there are several proposals, and I think one interesting thing to watch is Turkey, because Turkey is the powerful neighbour. Its border with Armenia has been closed since 1993. Turkey used to have conditions for how it would reopen, how and when it would reopen the border. Those conditions have actually been met now by the Armenian side, the previous conditions. But basically, it's in Turkey's strategic interest, and all the Turks I talk to say this, to open that border. It's good for the towns of eastern Turkey, which are the most depressed part of Turkey. They would have a new economic connection across the border with Armenia, new trade possibilities. It's good for Turkey strategically because it would weaken Russia, its historical rival, break Russia's monopoly hold over Armenia. Lots of reasons to do that. But as far as President Erdogan is concerned, he seems to feel that he's kind of made a promise of loyalty to his friend and ally, Ilham Aliyev, president of Azerbaijan, that he would not move on this before Azerbaijan did. But the question that I'm now asking is whether Turkey gets impatient on this. This window of being able to do a deal with Armenia is open only so long as Prime Minister Pashinyan is there. Are they prepared to keep on waiting, or do they want to move this forward? I surprise myself a bit talking about this because I've spent years studying this conflict, and I tend to be a pessimist. Things have often gone wrong, but I do see that the conditions are there for this agreement to work now, and it's just a matter of really a bit of more diplomacy and more flexibility. Not to say that the underlying issues of the conflict and the trauma, the injustice that everyone has suffered, that will obviously take a bit longer. But the political part of that deal, I think, it is ready to happen.
I'm glad you mentioned the Turkish dimension to the geopolitics in the Southern Caucasus, because in your recent essay for Engelsberg Ideas, you mentioned that. Well, you described the Southern Caucasus as a geopolitical marketplace now, and this fits into what you were saying earlier about the diversification of options, of diplomatic options in the region. And there are other powers such as India, China, and the Arab Gulf states that have been trying to exploit opportunities in the region. Could you take us through this geopolitical marketplace and what it looks like?
Yeah, well, it's complicated, and this region is complicated. Traditionally, it's been a east, west, north-south transit hub. It's a small region. If you take Georgia and Azerbaijan and Armenia together, probably no more than 17 million people in total living there. But obviously, geography matters. Particularly since, when you look at the war in Ukraine and the shutting down of Russia, and you look at all that's happened in Iran, suddenly this region becomes the default transit route that is neither Russia nor Iran, which raises its importance for Turkey, for China, for the EU, and you know, it becomes more of an investment possibility for other states like the Gulf states, you know, India also in there. So you know, this it does have oil and gas resources in Azerbaijan, but those are steadily diminishing. So its real you know, marketing factor is as this hub and transit corridor, and I think that is what generates most of the international interest. For Europe, it's slightly different. This is the neighbourhood. You know, this general European ambition to kind of weaken Russia's influence in its traditional neighbourhood. You know, the US obviously, you know, sees some economic opportunities there, which are possibly a bit exaggerated, but that's also another reason that the Trump administration is there. So this is all playing its role, and that this is what makes it, you know, basically a marketplace. and this is, I think, is something that the Russians just simply don't understand. You know, they still have these very out of date ideas that you know, these post-Soviet places are basically kind of close to us and will remain so.
So if you were a betting man, what do you think might happen next?
You know, I think, unfortunately, there are too many variables here. You know, I think the most positive scenario is that some creative solutions are found to finish this peace deal, that the borders open, that Armenia has open borders to the west. The Turkey border is obviously most important. And, you know, begins to diversify, that this also leads to a diversification of this rather narrow political space in Armenia. Armenia really needs a new democratic opposition, not this just bunch of pro-Russian proxies who comprise the opposition. That's the positive scenario. But, you know, plenty. The negative scenarios are that, you know, everything is unpredictable in this region. If you pin your hopes on one individual, that individual, something could happen to that individual. And, you know, also Iran is also obviously another destabilizing factor. But I think the longer term trend is for these countries to be more sovereign, less dependent on Russia. And that's, you know, basically a good news story.
I think that's a good note on which to end the conversation. Thomas Duval, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.